The following message comes to you from the pulpit of Bethlehem Primitive Baptist Church in Ocala, Alabama. To find out more information about Bethlehem Church, visit us online at bethlehempbc.org.
Good morning. Hope everybody is doing well this morning. When I get up here, I don't do it nearly as much anymore now that we got several ordained elders. It makes me appreciate not having to get up here. And as many times as I've messed up singing songs, you wouldn't think I'd be nervous standing here before you, but I still am a little bit. So I've had something on my mind for a while, and I'm very fortunate that I get an opportunity to share it. I want to thank Brother Luke for sharing the time. I know that he feels burdened to preach, and so I'm taking out of his time, so I'll stop talking and get right down to business. So in order to illustrate what I've had on my mind for a while, I want to tell you a passage that's not really, I don't think it's terribly familiar. I could use a whole number of Bible stories or Bible verses to illustrate this point, but I think I'll use this one because it's just been stuck with me. Several weeks ago, Brother Luke preached about Naaman the Syrian. If you were not here to hear that, you can hear it on our podcast. And he preached about how Naaman and the expectations Naaman had when he was going to be healed by Elisha. Now, this is in 2 Kings chapter 5, if you want to be turning there, and I'll kind of just summarize that story quickly. Naaman, the Syrian, came to the man of God, Elisha. He traveled quite some distance. He came to Elisha, who was the prophet. If you remember, Elisha was, I'll call it a trainee, maybe, under Elijah. And when Elijah died, Elisha had asked Elijah, what I want is a double portion of your spirit. And so Elijah said, well, if you're with me when I go to heaven, because we know that Elijah was called, you know, went into heaven in a fiery chariot. And he was given that double spirit. So Elisha was a pretty powerful prophet. And of course, the power all came from God, but he was a pretty powerful prophet. And so Naaman the Syrian travels some distance to see Elisha. Elisha tells him, well, go down here. I think Brother Luke says probably a week or two's distance to go down to the River Jordan. He does. He washes. And I'm leaving out a lot of stuff to get to the points that I want to get to. And he comes back. And when he comes back, he's gonna pay homage and attempt to reward Elisha. And so that starts in about verse 15 in 2 Kings chapter 5. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now, therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant. And he said, this is Elisha, as the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And so Naaman then, we're going to skip a few verses and go down to verse about 19 and go on to 20. But one thing I want you to notice there is how Naaman really tried to give Elisha something. He's like, let me give you anything. Thank you. But it reminds me very much of Abraham after the battle of the five kings. And he goes and rescue, or five verses four rather, and he goes to rescue Lot. And they try to give him spoils, if you will. And Abraham said, I won't even take a shoe latchet. He did not want to, one, he didn't want to be tied in any way to the pagans of that land, but he also knew that the victory came of God. And I think that Elisha feels the same way. He didn't want to have any ties to Naaman the Syrian. Not that Naaman personally was a bad guy, but the Syrians were a pagan nation. And also, he didn't do it. God did it. And so he wanted to make sure that he understood that. He didn't want to take a reward for that. So we go down to verse 19. And he said then, go in peace, and he departed from him a little way. But Gehazi, and that's who I want to talk about today. My kids unfortunately probably had to hear this for a couple weeks because I've been thinking about this. But I called this the tragedy of Gehazi the unwise. That's a little Star Wars thing if you're in a Star Wars. But so Gehazi is it really not known very much. He's mentioned from about 2 Kings 4 to about 2 Kings 8. He plays a very minor role, but it made a big impact on me when I was reading it. So in verse 20 it says, but Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master has spared Naaman, this Syrian. and not receiving at hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him." Gehazi is being overcome by covetousness at this point. He's impulsive. He's thinking, "Naaman, this Syrian." He's sort of it's sort of a sneering way he says that. "Naaman, this Syrian." He says, "I'm going to go take somewhat of him." And, well, let me back up here. It says, "In not receiving at his hands that which he brought." Again, Elisha didn't bring it. He was the mean. He was the instrument of God, if you will. And he says, "As the Lord liveth," he uses an oath. So he's getting very rebellious at this point. He's using an oath. He's basically taking the Lord's name in vain right there when he says, "As the Lord liveth." And not that it's wrong to say that, because Elisha had said it earlier, but he didn't say it in vain. "I will run after him and take somewhat of him." And somewhat is kind of an interesting word there. We think somewhat would be analogous to something, and it is, but it also gives a connotation of a spot, a blemish, a mark on something. And you'll see a little bit later what that means. So Gehazi follows after Naaman, and when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him, and he said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master sent me, saying, 'Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments.'" Line number one. "And Naaman said, 'Be content and take two talents.' And he urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and laid them upon two of his servants, and they bare them before him. And he came to the tower. He took them from their hand, the goods that he had taken, and bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed." I'll stop right there just to discuss this. So he tells a lie. He was not sent by anybody. There weren't more men coming. And he says, "A talent of silver," which, you know, if Google is right, and it could be wrong, I suppose, but I looked on several places trying to find how much a talent is. It's pretty significant. It's about 72 pounds. That's a lot of silver. In today's money, that silver would be worth over $1 million. 72 pounds of silver is not something you're just going to put in your pocket. And that's why the two servants helped him carry not only two talents, 140 pounds of silver, and two changes of clothes. It's not something you can easily conceal. So going back to the story, they help him carry all the things back to the house, and then the servants of Naaman the Syrian leave. And he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, "Whence comest thou, Gehazi?" And he said, "Thy servant went nowhither." Line number two. So doesn't this sound familiar to God when he's walking through the garden in the cool of the day? And he says, "Where art thou?" And they say, "Well, we're hiding because we didn't know we're naked." Adam and Eve, of course, I'm referring to. Sounds very familiar to me. As if God didn't know what Adam and Eve were doing. And so now we've got Elisha. And Gehazi tells him, "Thy servant went nowhither. I didn't go anywhere." And Elisha said unto him, "Went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? The leprosy, therefore, of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And he went out of his presence, a leper, as white as snow. Does that strike you as kind of an overwhelming sentence, maybe disproportional to what he's done? It did me when I read it. I thought, wow, he told two lies and he took some goods, but that seems like a terrible punishment. But I don't claim to understand exactly why it deserved what it did, but we know that Elisha cursed Gehazi right there with his seed, and his seed, it says, "Cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever." And that's basically the last we hear of Gehazi. In chapter 8, we do hear of Gehazi, but I believe the timeline is such that it happened before that, even though it's later in the chapter. I believe that, I don't know that, I like to think that Gehazi was a child of God. We don't know all his motivations for staying with Elisha, but I believe that he was a child of God. Think about the blessings that Gehazi enjoyed just by being with Elisha. Think about the things that he saw. He saw Naaman get healed, of course. He saw Naaman get healed of leprosy. He saw Elisha restore the Shunammite's woman's son to life. When he could not, he tried to and could not do it. But Naaman was overcome with covetousness. And you might say he got impulsive. And he was drawn away of his own lust, like it says in James chapter 1. Every man, when he is tempted, is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. For whatever reason, Gehazi did not resist the temptation that he was faced with. And so now he's cursed with leprosy, which if you don't know anything about leprosy, and of course I don't even think most of us have probably never even seen a case, again, unless you've gone to Google and looked at it like I did the other day, and looked at it. It looks pretty bad, is what I'll say. The Bible, let me back up and say this. Gehazi had a choice to make. Now, Gehazi, feeling this urge to get something from Naaman the Syrian, could have resisted. He could have gotten down on his knees and prayed. He could have gone to Elisha and saying, why can't we have some of that? And talk to him and say, help me get over my covetousness. But he didn't. And just like a lot of people in the Bible, and just like us, we have a lot of choices we have to make. I sometimes think of that George Jones song about choices. We won't sing that, of course, this morning, but if you've never heard that, it's a pretty good song. Think about the choices. God gives us a lot of examples in the Bible. People made choices. He talks about Adam and Eve, who, of course, very quickly made a very bad choice. We talk about Abraham. Abraham was a man who really followed God. Of course, we also know that he made some choices. They couldn't wait on God, he and his wife Sarah. They just didn't wait on God, and so tried to bring the promised seed into ready before God was ready. Samson was bestowed with incredible mighty power, but he just could not or would not turn away from the lust of the flesh. Strange women just really appealed to him. These children of God had choices. Now, I think everybody under the sound of my voice knows that we're not talking about an eternal choice before them. We're talking about just the choices that people have before them in time. So God gives us these examples. I mean, maybe King David is one of the best examples of someone who just really made shipwreck his life. King David, a lot of the problems that King David faced are a result of one really bad choice. I'm not saying that David didn't make a lot of bad choices, but he made one really bad one when he committed adultery with Bathsheba and then had her husband killed. And it affected his family forever. So do you think, if you don't think very highly of sin and what the impact it has, you can see from David's family that sin doesn't just stick with you. Sin is generational. You ought to think about that when you're willingly committing a sin. I don't mean that there's a curse brought upon you necessarily when you commit a sin. What I mean is the sin that you commit has a direct impact on the people around you, people in the church, the people in your home, your parents, your children, and that sin may follow with them also. And so it gives you a different perspective of the sin that we commit. One of the I thought of when I was studying this, and I was just very troubled. I was thinking, man, Gehazi blew it. He really blew it. I can imagine him after this all happened, he was thinking about how he just went wrong. He probably looked at that silver over in there in the corner and said, what am I going to do with all this money? I mean, when we have bad health, would we not trade all we've got for good health? Don't you know that Gehazi would have given all that money right back and more, everything he had, to be healed of that leprosy? I'm sure he would have. But I went to Psalm 42, if you'll go there with me. And this struck me. Again, this is something I've kind of been burdened with for a while, and I read this psalm in a different way than I've read it before. And most of you are familiar with the song, at least the song that's associated with this psalm. As thirst the heart for water brooks. We've sung that song plenty of times in singing school and here. So in verse 1 it says, as the heart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. My soul thirsteth for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my meat day and night, while they continually say unto me, where is thy God? When I remember these things, I pour out my soul in me. For I had gone with the multitude. I went with them to the house of God with the voice of joy and praise, with the multitude that kept holy day. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? And why art thou disquieted in me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him for the help of his countenance. A lot of people believe that this psalm was written and recorded after Absalom was attempting to, basically made David flee the city, and so he's really cast down. But look, this is what really struck me. It says, when I remember these things in verse 4. Now, we know in Romans 8:28, when we say these things, we know what he's talking about. It really could mean one of two things the way I read it. When I remember these things, it could be he's remembering the insults that were hurled upon him by the other people. Where is thy God? But it also could be what he's about to say. It is a colon right after that. My wife was an English teacher. I don't know anything about English, but I do know that when there's a colon, it means you're about to say something going forward that's related to what you're saying now. So it says, when I remember these things, I pour out my soul in me, colon. For I had gone with the multitude. I went with them to the house of God with the voice of joy and praise, with the multitude that kept holy day. I believe David is thinking about the times when he went to church. David went to church and he says, he's so cast down right there. And he's going like, I remember going to church. If he were living today, he'd say, I remember going to church. And I remember that sweet fellowship we had. I remember that singing and the preaching and the praying. I remember how I could lay my burdens on my friends there at church, and how the preacher could encourage me, and how the preacher could lift me up through the Spirit of God would lift me up through the preacher for the rest of the week. And David was saying, I remember going there with the multitude, the joy, the praise, the multitude that kept holy day. That's the festival. He is remembering going to church as a form of encouragement. He is down, and he's thinking about, I believe, he's very down, he's thirsting for God, and he's thinking about those times that he was rejoicing in God. He's thinking about the time when he had peace at the church. He's being cast out. His own son is trying to usurp the throne from him. And so David is cast down. But the very next thing, when he's remembering going to church, he says, why are you cast down? Why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why are you disquieted me? Hope thou in God. I will praise him in the help of his countenance. David is encouraged by going to church. Excuse me. I do have to take some notes. I'm not like Brother Luke and Brother Neil and Brother Tim. Have you thought about that? Have you ever left church after a meeting? I mean, just a normal meeting like this, or after church after a weekend meeting, and felt so lifted up and just felt like you were on cloud nine, and then Monday morning rolls around. And then you go to work and you just feel dragged down throughout the week. And I long, like Brother Luke mentioned in his opening, that Wednesday night service where you can go get recharged. Well, I believe that's exactly what David is doing. He was thinking about that. Don't you know that Gehazi, with leprosy, was sitting there thinking he longed to be in Elisha's presence again. He longed to be with God. He longed to have fellowship. Gehazi, if he was a child of God, didn't lose his status as an elect child through his disobedience. We know that. But he lost the fellowship. He lost Elisha. And we go on to see Elisha performing all kinds of miracles. And I know that I can imagine as Gehazi heard about these things that Elisha was doing, he's going like, I could be there with him. I could be enjoying that fellowship, that sweet fellowship. All that silver didn't mean anything to him at that point. Dear friends, let's don't let this be our story. Let's don't let our life be a life of regret. You've heard it said before that you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Brother Furman has told me about the times when this church here was 6-8 people. And he's talked about how poor in spirit the church was. And now look at it. In some of the cases, some of our children have never experienced a bad time or a downtime. It doesn't have to be that way. It does not have to be that way. The Lord's church is special, and it should be our treasure. I want you to think and look around this church, because I have reflected on this many times about the friendships I have here. How many marriages have been improved or even saved at this church? Mine has, just through godly preaching and through godly examples that I see around here. How about friendships? Anybody had troubles in friendships and then have them restored and drawn closer to people through common experience here at church? Mine has. Have your children benefited from coming to this church and seeing the godly examples of all the godly men and women here, and seeing godly examples of slightly older children, the way we all sit together and we're not cast away in different classes, you know, in Sunday school and that kind of stuff? We can see the younger children. It always gratifies me so much and warms my heart to see how much an interest the older children take in the younger children. I don't think you can get that anywhere. It's an incredible blessing. Let me just ask you this question. How would your life be? What do you think your life would be like if you could not or would not come here on Sunday mornings and didn't have the godly friends you have and how much love and support you have experienced at this church? Well, I'll tell you my answer to that question. My life is infinitely richer and sweeter because of the church, because of the love that I have experienced here at this church, because of the friendships, because of how I have drawn so much closer to the Lord through the wonderful preaching we get to hear from the three preachers that we have. I've learned so much more about the Lord. I've learned what a rotten sinner I am, but I've also learned about the salvation that I have waiting for me. I was trying to think of a way, how can I describe it to you? I rejoice knowing that one day we'll all be together in heaven, but the only thing I could come up with, and some young kids wouldn't even probably relate to this, is before and after Bethlehem. You know, you've seen those things say, this is your brain on drugs, whatever. It's like black and white color, black and white TV to color television set. It's a whole different dimension because of this church. That's how important church is to me. If that's not your experience, if that's not your experience of Bethlehem today, if you don't think your life is infinitely sweeter and richer than it was before you started coming here, I don't think you've truly experienced it. Now, that's not a criticism. I just want to tell you, I don't think you've truly experienced it, and I'm so sorry that you have not. So you may be saying to yourself, if you're one of those people who have not experienced this experience that I'm telling you about, was, I want that experience. How do I get that? I want that love, that joy, that peace. How can I get those things? Or maybe it's, I want to come to church instead of sort of having to get myself there. Let's go to Matthew 13 briefly. And if you look in chapter 13, verse about, there's a bunch of parables of the kingdom right here. Some are eternal and some are in time. And I'm going to read you very, very quickly two parables. Verse 44, Matthew 13, verse 44. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all he hath and buyeth that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man seeking goodly pearls, who when he hath found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. Now, the Lord isn't telling us here to go sell our house, our guns, our cars, our jewelry, to buy the church. He's not telling us that. He is telling us the instruction is for the gospel. We are in the kingdom of heaven right now. We're in the kingdom of heaven, and we're very blessed where we are. Like I said at the very beginning, if we make this church our treasure, Matthew 6:21 tells us that where our treasure is, there will your heart be also. Have you made this church your treasure, the gospel, the kingdom of heaven? Have you made it your treasure? Have you saved up to possess it? And you, some of you may be looking at me like I still have no idea what you're trying to say. Have you invested like the men who represented in these parables did, who went and sold all they had to possess that goodly pearl? Have you done that? Again, it's not talking about selling everything that you own and getting rid of all your worldly possessions. What it means is investing in the church. How do I do that? Well, let me think about it this way. If I want to have a relationship with somebody, if I tell somebody I'm very close to somebody, what you probably picture in your mind is, oh, well, Brother Jim probably visits that person. Maybe they call or text, you know, frequently. Maybe they go out to lunch together. They go hunting or fishing together. You know, they write emails to one another. In other words, we communicate with each other. If I never wrote a friend, I seldom have anything to say to them other than just small talk, like, hey, we got about an inch of rain last night or something like that. Do I really have a relationship with that person? I have not invested in that relationship. I guarantee if you don't invest in your marriage, it won't be worth much. But if you take the time to invest in your marriage, it will be worth something. If I go to church out of a sense of duty, sort of miserably going to church because I know I got to, and I dust off my Bible now and then, pray once in a while, am I developing a relationship with the Lord? This stings me a little bit, y'all, because I don't always do that the way I should. I'm pretty good about getting to church. I'm pretty good about reading the Bible. I'm not very good about praying. I really have struggled to try to make that a bigger part of my day. So I'm talking to myself when I say this. But what I have found is that when I do just one step towards God, and He just rewards you ever excessively more abundantly than you can ever imagine, just one step towards God, if you study, if you pray, if you reach out and serve other people, the Lord will just reward you so abundantly. He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. We know that. If we make this church and the Lord our treasure, guess what? Our heart will follow after that. So if you're struggling to make this church your treasure, if you're struggling to enjoy the kingdom of heaven the way that I've described to you, there is a formula. It can be done. Let's don't be like David and Gehazi and in those later years lamenting about the things we could have done or that we should have done. And just, again, I can just picture Gehazi in my mind's eye laying there just miserably eaten up with leprosy, wishing he could give all that gold back to have that relationship. Not only the skin, his skin being restored was important to him, I guarantee you that. But to have that relationship. I know he was just like David when David was imagining in Psalm 42 about the joy he experienced when he came to church and the love he experienced at church and how it filled him. It just filled his spiritual man up. David and Gehazi had lost years. They lost out on enjoying the unspeakable blessings of love and all the fellowship of the saints. Let's don't do that. Recall how David reminded himself and encouraged himself through worship. I urge you to draw nigh unto Him, and He will draw nigh unto you. Thank you, brother. Brother Luke, come on ahead.
Thank you, Brother Jim. Wow, there's so much that could be said about that. And part of me wants to just keep on going with it because that was very, very good. I'll just say this, that concerning Gehazi there, sin never will benefit you, ever. Now, it may be pleasurable for a season, as the Bible tells us, but the sin in our lives and the things that we choose to do that are against God's commandments for us will only ever bring you heartache. It may just take it some time. Now, with Gehazi here, what you see is a very immediate consequence that he saw. His payment for his sin in this life was very immediate, but we don't always see it that way. Sometimes you may make a decision when you're 20 and you not really feel it until you're 40. And I would encourage any of you, especially some of you younger ones, to beg God for wisdom in the decisions that you make, because the decisions that you make now may have tremendous impacts on what your life is like on down the road. Sometimes we see the leprosy come on us immediately, and sometimes it's years down the road before that happens. I think about Asaph too, Brother Jim, who was very cast down and almost to the point of apostasy because he saw the wicked. It seemed like the wicked always prospered, and that he was suffering as a godly man. And he said, I was almost torn apart by this until I went to the sanctuary of God. So this church is a wonderful place, and it is the most blessed place. It is a place that you need to be planted and to grow up in and to thrive in. And you may say, you know what, Brother Luke, I've been to this church a few times, and I just don't feel it. It's similar to what Brother Jim mentioned. Maybe you come in here and you just don't feel it. Well, you know, I can remember when I was a child, I would ask my parents something, and they'll say, you'll understand when you're older. You'll understand when you're older. And maybe what they were telling me was, you just need some time. Well, maybe you just need some time to just sit here and just be exposed to the singing and the preaching and the sweet fellowship. And maybe in time, you'll see how precious it is. Okay, so I encourage you to take hold of the words that Brother Jim gave us this morning. Wonderful, wonderful exhortation.